You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap? Here's Parisha.
Greetings, and hello, and happy winter and happy spring in the southern spring. We're having great seasons all over our planet. And now we're seeing a change of power and a change of attitude and a whole lot of other things. So we know that Creator's right on time. And as we explore Dr. Fred Allen's Wolf on Mind into Matter, I hope it helps us understand our humanity greater yet, okay? So as things progress, let us always maintain the fact that we need to stay open to fully understand both sides and all sides of the elephant so that we know at least where to, particularly to have a perspective or a view. My co-host will join us this week. I have Trina Cooper from Denver, Colorado. I have Marianne Love from Melbourne, Australia. And I have Rosemarie Heyer from Frankfurt, Germany. Joyce Mullenhauer from Kingman, Arizona. And I don't see Geraldine. Is she there? Anyway, Geraldine Dalby Ball joins us also from Sydney. My co-hosts are beautiful women with very high intelligent levels with lots and lots of spirituality. So I welcome you all, ladies, and let's definitely close this book on chapter 9 with actually giving the greatest impact of what it offers. And reading chapter 9, I don't know what the rest of you got, but it was really very, very powerful. And as we know that in Mind into Matter, Dr. Wolf has used the Hebrew glyphs to actually bring the very various equations of science to them. And the glyphs are very, very powerful. I've made in-depth study of the Hebrew glyphs, and you're talking about a very ancient symbology that's represented in each one of them with given characters. And when you actually know them and study them and see the combinations of them, you begin to understand a greater deal of chemistry, universal chemistry, as well as quantum physics and the sciences. And so he kind of sums that up for us here in chapter 9. That actually starts on page 120. Let's see, it's 131. Yeah, page 131, chapter 9. And it's called Structure and Beauty, Spirit and Soul. And I'm going to let actually Trina from Denver to actually start. Trina is actually, Trina, are you converted to Judaism or your husband and family?
Husband and family. Okay. I love the background of it. I love the spirit of it.
Okay. You share often your stories with as a young woman, as a Catholic. So it's like, okay, so you've explored the realm of different religions and beliefs, and that's always very interesting, isn't it? It's a great adventure. Let's start out, Trina, by actually you reading the little caption that starts the thing, and then like I said, we may here and there, for our listeners, we may here and there actually read certain parts of the context, but mostly we would like to just relate to you what he's saying and actually some points that we feel we could make on that, okay? So Trina, if you want to start, that would be great.
Sure. This is chapter 9, Mind into Matter, Structure and Beauty, Spirit and Soul. The dual substance of Christ, the yearning so human, so superhuman of man to attain God has always been a deep, inscrutable mystery to me. My principal anguish and source of all my joys and sorrows from my youth onward has been the incessant, merciless battle between the spirit and the flesh. And my soul is the arena where these two armies have clashed and met. This is Nikos Kantzakis, The Last Temptation of Christ.
I so appreciate you reading that, because as I sit here in my 80th year of life, I look back over it as all of us do, and I'm sure you do too. There's this constant, I don't know if it's a battle or just this constant pull and tug of resistance and then succumbing to it between spirit and body. And I know that all of you are on the same track as I am, where we're continuing to explore enlightenment and realization. And when you read this, doesn't this just go to the very heart of it for you? It's like you're in the midst of seeking and moving and obtaining total enlightenment, and you realize how you have to keep then trying to find some understanding of body and spirit. And then we have to deal with the statement, we're not the body, which is obviously very much what science has now shown us, as well as can be proven. So when I read this, it is the merciless battle between the spirit and the flesh. And I don't know that I want to use merciless, because I feel that in the midst of my confusion or the hardest points of trying to understand, I always feel there's a presence there that eases me through it. So, but this I feel is a very strong quote, and I personally will continue to go back to it once in a while just to stimulate reviews and thoughts on it. And Trina, you're going to tell us what the rest of that says?
Absolutely. This was one, the first time I read it, like I'm sure the first time other people read it, it seemed quite confusing. And so I needed to sit down and go, okay, let's take this bit by bit and really take it in, keeping in mind the fact that we've got this bit of a struggle where we move from being moved by spirit and being moved with what our bodies want us to do all the time. So in this beginning of this chapter, he again reminds us, and he's starting to kind of circle back with some of the things from his introduction, bringing them back forward again, that we look at this notion of spirit and soul from a perspective of new alchemy. So if you needed to go back and remind yourself, what was new alchemy? His description of new alchemy is new concepts, a new way of seeing the old way, a melding of the ideas of ancient knowledge and modern vision from the quantum physics perspective to reach a fuller understanding of mind into matter, spirit coming into matter. So if you keep that in mind, he says there's a key insight here that matter and spirit are in conflict with each other. That's part of who we are as we move through life. And he says to work through this conflict, to get to this ultimate transformation, it is really the story of the evolution of the human being from the Adam Kadmon, which is a term he gave us earlier in the book, its original source, life's original source. So when we go back and we take a look at Adam Kadmon, if you remember, the first being, it was that being that had the light of the divine coming out through every orifice, from its eyes, from its ears, from its fingertips. It's the being where all life originates. And as he talked about the mystics earlier, he said their journey was to become the Adam Kadmon. So when they become fully realized, when they realize that they are the image of God, that they are God, they circle back around and become the Adam Kadmon again. And that was the round trip he was talking about. We end up where we began. We came from the light. We are the light. Sometimes we forget we're the light. And then we move back to being the light again. So in this, he breaks down the Adam Kadmon again. And he said, Adam comes from those words, Aleph, Dalet, Mem. Kadmon comes from Kaf, Dalet, Mem, Vav, Nun. And that this has a very, very symbolic meaning. We're talking about Aleph, spirit, meeting resistance, which is Dalet, Mem. And through this resistance, the resistance transforms the consciousness into cosmic possibilities. So keep in mind again, Dalet is the resistance, Aleph is spirit. Now he brings a new concept into play here, which talks about the fact that Dalet Mem can be written two different ways. One, The Dalit never changes. Resistance doesn't change.
Mm-hmm.
It does. There's a final form, and there's what he calls a regular form. So the final form is when we've when we've moved through this idea of resistance, and we've come all the way through, and it creates a cosmic or final ending, an ending that has incredible possibilities, where the mem regular is an evolved resistance. It's kind of what we're moving through all the time, is the way that I see it. And he said it literally refers to the water that makes up 85% of the brain. This means that without this water, our brains wouldn't function. We wouldn't be able to have experiences. We wouldn't be able to remember things. The brain's electrical activity is important to us. This body piece of us is important, and consciousness would not occur if the brain wasn't working. It wouldn't occur for us. So we have to keep in mind that Aleph meets resistance, and we can either transform, or we're working through, where we're evolving through this. Another insight he brings forward in the word Adam, that Dalit Mem actually means blood in Hebrew. So we're literally talking about Aleph, spirit, in blood. We're talking about spirit in matter. That's exactly who we are. So the final piece that's here, when he talks about Kadmam, we're getting into the round trip concept now, is the fact that Kaf Dalit Mem in Kadmam, it's an exalted form of spirit, an exalted form of Aleph. So when we really look at Adam Kadmam, we're looking at Aleph, spirit coming into existence. It is the recognition that it comes into the blood, into the human form, into the body. And when we reconcile this, he uses the word reconcile. So that means when these two coexist in harmony, we have endless creation, endless fertilization. We can become fully cosmic human beings. Fully, we get it to experience full realization. And so this is our story. This is what we are doing as human beings, is we're literally recognizing and harmonizing spirit in matter. And that was the full circle. That was the coming around. We come in as spirit. We might lose it when we're in the human form. We seek it. And as we create this harmony in ourselves between spirit and our matter self, we can become fully realized Adam Kadmam, a fully realized light being in matter.
Very, very good. There's a part there too, Trina, on 132. And the reason I caught that was, you know, there's very few people that understand that what we call empty space is primal water, are the primal waters, okay? And that we ourselves, our bodies, are anywhere from 70 to 80% water, because we think of it only as solid mass, right? And here he actually brings up again that it's actually referring literally to the water that makes up 80% of our brain. Okay, so when we're looking at the fact that he brings up again that these glyphs actually show, again, bring the attention to the water on our brain and the importance of that. And how when we broadcast or send anything out through what we think is open space, it is the finite small presence of water in all things that actually makes it resonate. And so what I did with what you read and shared here, Trina, is that I just kept compelling me to go back through the glyphs and actually draw the glyphs that actually make up the combinations that you just discussed, the different combinations were. And when I wrote that up, okay, I began to actually feel like I closed my eyes and just went into the presence around me. Remember, beloveds, that symbols and drawings and mandalas that we draw and everything else brings the mathematical effects or the measure of frequency into something. And I have to explore it more, but I want to share it with all of you. I really, really was impressed with what started happening inside my meditation and the different kind of, at first it was just seeing the possibility that there was something moving in the blackness. And then it actually became designs. And every time it was a design, there seemed to be a burst of light. So I realized immediately that the symbols were communicating. So definitely give that a try. And what I did was just take the combinations of which he gives definition to and put them together. Cause then, you know, I made a little directory on the side of my paper of each of the glyphs and the names of the glyphs. And then I put the combinations together. It is talking. So don't just briefly, you know, grab what Trina shared with Adam Cadman here. No, find out how much this actually vibrates and what it does. Okay, and we have Geraldine Dalby-Ball, Geraldine way down there in Sydney, and taking care of our forest and our creatures there, I bet, right? And I want you to cover
time of year for that.
Wonderful. I want you to cover the next part, kind of pick it up from where Trina gave us and see, give us some greater understanding, okay?
Yeah, well, a wonderful part that Trina was able to bring us to is spirit in blood, which is saying, wow. This next part is really saying the whole amazingness of it. And I actually looked up the word behold, because if I read what is written, it's about how it can be incredibly frightening and bleak without the realization that we are spirit in matter. That's the first point that's brought in next. But likewise, and opposite, but in a beautiful place, the words are, with the recognition of one's spiritual nature, however, the journey becomes heartfelt and beautiful to behold. So I looked up the word behold, and it's to see and observe, not just that, to see and observe something remarkable and impressive. So just as Trina introduced, to get that moment where there's the observation of how remarkable and impressive every one of us are, that we are spirit in flesh, every single one of us, not just Adam Cadman or Buddha or Jesus, or every single one of us to be alive is spirit in flesh. And as Dr. Wolf shares, that's something to behold. It's something to see, to observe, to feel how remarkable and impressive it is. And in this moment, okay, it may be relatively easy for me to say that. I have enough food. I have a house. I have a beautiful place. Nature is abundant here. Friends, families, teachers. Can we also find these moments and assist in bringing this information when there are those dark moments? And not to wish the dark moments gone either, because he goes on to say that these come together. So let's look at that part as well. First is this beholding can occur out there. So if there's a particular moment, we can actually move our attention to out there and behold the beauty that's there. Likewise, and of most power is in here to move that attention to behold the beauty that is within, and know how remarkable we are. And as it says, the beholding not only occurs out there using light to see, but occurs in the mind's eye, our imaginal realm. So we have that ability to hold the splendor and the complete evolution of the soul coming to the realization that it is spirit in this body. And it's this sentence really, I realized it was quite profound. So I'm still working with it, still reading it, still having it there, in that he shared with us that the ability to behold the splendor and complete the evolution that the soul and the revelation of the meaning of each and everyone's existence in matter is the secret of the ancient alchemy, and it's what this book is based on. So just here, this one sentence, that ability to behold the splendor of our evolution of soul and the meaning of our existence as a physical form, that's the secret. The secret is exposed. We now know what it is. It goes on to share as well, one that I'm quite passionate about is, from being an ecologist, when I look into the world, I do not see that the Darwin theory of survival of the fittest is the be-all and end-all. The more I look and the more others look, the more we're seeing that cooperation and integration and the things called symbioses, where things work together, is the normal. That is what I see when I look into a forest. The ants are helping this, the fungi is helping the trees, the bees have a particular resonance in their wings. That sound makes the flower open up to present its pollen and nectar more easily for that particular bee species. Everywhere around are these cooperations. So he goes here to say, if we remain stuck in the paradigm of Darwinian evolution, which is survival of the fittest, competition, I win, you lose, we're destined to believe that evolution is purely an accident. And that we're, you know, a whole, and as he says, where's beauty? Where's beauty, hope, purpose? And then as Dr. Wolf says, I can't fathom what life would be like without hope, beauty, and purpose. So we can step away from that idea that we're just mechanistic and we're here and then we're gone. What would life be like without hope, beauty, and purpose? And that's specifically what he says. So it's not just about survival, survival, survival. And then how can we move in our own existence? That's what I've had to ask myself. Then within a day, how much day is actually looking for and putting focus on hope, beauty, and purpose, and how much the day is putting on survival, survival. And then if we can master that, obviously that can emanate. The other part in this this little section here is sharing this concept that the all around us is vibrations, and we can say that soul is keyed into the vibrations. So again, that ability to look outside of yourself for a moment and realize that's a projection, and then how do we change it? We change the vibration. And so he shared an analogy here so that we can again have some physical visualization. He said, imagine a vibrating string, like a violin string, but just it's really long, it keeps going, and that different things happen that allow that vibration to keep going. It may change, but it's always there. So that vibrating string is the soul, that frequency that's coming out is ever present. And then he says, and also imagine a mirror. If you have a mirror, you know, he doesn't necessarily say what to do with the mirror, but he says by having the mirror, you've also got the reflecting back of the image of what we call the real world. So when we're using our physical senses and looking, we can imagine that's like a mirror, which is a very interesting thing that we can ask ourselves. If what we're seeing in the real world is a mirror, what's it reflecting? It's reflecting what we put there. And then we can say, if we have this vibrating string, which is our soul, what is that vibrating doing in terms of putting what we then see in the mirror? So it really asks us to take full responsibility. And within all of that, just know how remarkable and impressive it is to be spirit in matter. And there was one other word that I looked up, which is the word revelation, because he says we'll come to a revelation. And again, this is a powerful word. It's not just we start to understand. Revelation, the definitions are along the lines of communicating with the divine, or it's a truth revealed by God to humans, or it's the having the revealing, so the showing, of something enlightening. So again, we're really shown that this, what Trina has shared, understanding that we're spirit in matter and that we have a full circle to our soul, is the essence that the whole book is about. that the whole secret ancient alchemy is about.
Really?
And that's where I'll leave it.
That's really, really good. And I love the part where he says he personally loves the fact that we have these experiences and can experience ourselves as love and on purpose. I think that Joyce can actually take us from where you let off here. Joyce, are you there and you want to share from there?
Sure. It's interesting that he leads further from the one vibrating string to the fact that scientists have envisioned in a metaphor form that the vacuum could be totally filled with infinite number of vibrating strings. So those strings are all representing spirit. And because there is such an immense number of vibrating strings, the vacuum itself, which normally, and I looked up vacuum because I wanted to understand a little bit more exactly what a vacuum is. A vacuum is usually devoid of matter. So all those strings are something added in this metaphor. And a vacuum would usually have no movement. So I think this example is excellent that you have this infinite number of vibrating strings that is the spirit, and you have actual movement in the vacuum because of spirit. And the vacuum is representing soul. So he's giving us a chance to see where spirit starts and ends and where the soul picks up and how they interact with each other. So he does discuss this, I think, pretty scientifically and with not a strong science basis in my brain. I had to look up a number of words here. There are even to figure out atmospheric pressure means normally that's the pressure of the air, and closer to the planet, the more pressure there is, the further away, the less pressure. So he's giving us this chance to see the reflections of the vibrating vacuum being representing soul and how it does emanate outwards. And then he brings in consciousness and mind, and he talks about them arise either one of those. He's not separating those two. So consciousness or mind in general arises whenever a reflection in time occurs. So now he's brought in the element of time. And I'm sure one of the other co-hosts will discuss this a little further, because he talks about the beginning of time and the end of time, the Big Bang and the Big Crunch. And within that time loop, actually the soul exists, and the soul is a one unit, and which we all are connected with. So he's taking us beyond any individual person to contemplate being part of that one soul.
Okay, very, very good. Thank you. And I really want to say to our listeners, you really need to buy this book, and you need to take time with this book. And I can actually say, because I am certain of this, if you took time to totally integrate what you're learning out of this book and what Dr. Wolf gives us here, you would actually have a state of enlightenment that would be all the totality of what we are here to explore. And if you have to take time, Wolf can get very deep in some of the ways he presents, especially in this case using the Hebrew glyphs and stuff. While the magic of that actually enhances this, if you play with the glyphs, okay, it also, each point that he makes begins to help you arrive to the knowledge of where we're going and how we're going to get there. And when we get toward the conclusion of this chapter, it's all about what I have taught all my life, and that's pretty much 70 years of teaching, okay, that we return where we began, that our inevitable track through matter and time is nothing other than a very short point. It's not even a dot in the matrix of the universe. And yet we give so much sacrifice to the body. We sacrifice so much of our enlightened beauty and to live in this total state of matter and time in a beautiful, magical way. And I think that he constantly brings us back to just embracing that it is a very simple thing. and that all of the complex things are in the sciences of it, and they're already worked out. They just help your mind kind of come to know, okay? But the living of what he's saying actually delivers us to the very, very mystical part of what life can be and the beauty of that. On the bottom of page 134, I'm going to actually read what he says here. When reflections are from points in space, then those become essentially unconscious chunks of matter. Thus, time forms the arena of consciousness, and space forms the arena of unconsciousness. Of course, the distinction between consciousness and unconsciousness is more complex than this, since space and time fuse together according to relativity theory and the behavior of light. How do you understand something like that? See, this is something that you could sit down and think, you know, if you're going to read a nice romance story in order to just kind of have that kind of adventure, you have to spend time with a paragraph like that. And you have to wrap your mind around it. So where he says, of course, the distinction between consciousness and unconsciousness is more complex than this. Yes. But then he goes on to say, since space and time fuse together, according to relativity theory and the behavior of light. Well, again, I would say what I very much, Geraldine, that you showed us, look up the words according to relativity theory and then the behavior of light. See, we still are clinging more to the matter, and we're actually calling it flesh. And of course, when we relate to it as flesh, we obviously relate very easily to the body because that's what we see. That's what we experience. That's what we have been brainwashed to have. But it's not. It's light. The Adam Cadman thing and everything that Trina was sharing and everything, that is the reality of us. And if you saw the reality of us as far as energy, you would see the lightness of what that is. And then what he's covering here is that when we deal with consciousness, which is what we believe or how we think and how we carry on, through the thinking and the creating process, okay? It's the actual relativity of what we would call time and measure and the behavior of light. We are the light, okay? He goes on to say the self because it reflects a consciousness, okay? The self because it reflects a consciousness, which means the soul, in unconscious matter, matter not having any sense of that, contains both elements, which is the elements of what? Relativity and light. So the self behaves both consciously and unconsciously. And we know that because we're not consciously telling ourselves to breathe. We're not, you know, if we don't tell our heart to beat, there is a subconscious level to our existence. Okay, being alive and continually processing information makes the descriptions of the soul and self difficult. So the challenge we face is to define the process rather than the entities themselves. The giving and vibrant soul subjectively experiences life through our bodies. Okay. And that is the use and the sacredness of the body. We experience and we can do things in this dimension only because we have a body. We have disembodied people who are sharing space, time, and where we're at, but they do not have the privilege of what you and I do as long as we maintain the collective of a body. So he deals more. If you really get your headset here, he's really dealing more with what we are actually, that we are spirit continuously and everlasting. And that we have this precious moment here that we can actually work through and with the body and experience things we can't experience or don't experience as spirit, like emotions. Like even the fact that sadness is a gift. To feel sad is a gift because it is a feeling. And the body is what allows us to have the feelings, the emotions. And so when we talk about consciousness and unconsciousness, we are more unconscious than we are conscious because we don't sit and ponder that. We don't sit and think about that. To sit with such information, and like I said, just a paragraph of what he's saying, is actually going to be mind-opening and free and liberate some of the hardwired perceptions that we have. So he says over on 135, when we go within to an internal quietness, as in meditation, we begin to perceive something deeper and more meaningful than just the objective, our out-there-ness. So if we have lost touch with our souls, we need to spend some quiet time, not in thinking, not in going over the day's list of everything that has to be done, but in being with ourselves in ways that allow a deeper inner reality to bubble up from the within of our consciousness. And this is one of the things I point out when people are meditating. They control and actually do what I call guided meditations. No, you want to sit and actually observe the randomness and all of the thoughts that will come up until there is, once all of the, what I consider the confusion and everything, and the mind is talking. If you sit with it long enough and just say, be still, then you come to where he's talking about here. And it's in those moments that you are in the universe and you are in the consciousness of what comes. Even at the end of life, we simply return to where we began. Okay. I'm going to ask Marianne Love to pick it up from there. Marianne, you want to add to that?
Sure. Well, here he gives a really good example, I think, of how most of us could identify, because he's saying on a human level, some people will view their lives as, oh my God, what did I live for? Isn't it terrible? I'm going to die. And life's black when it started, bleak when I was here, then it's black again when it ends. So it goes from bleak to black to bleak to black again. And I know certainly in the work that I do, that's a lot of the work is helping people not identify in that way with the experience of life as a negative, because we have a choice in all of it. But what he's saying there, though, that he really believes that this is all designed into God's system, which I know will be shocking for people, because how would such a wonderful God create such despairing experiences of being human? But in fact, he's saying that the me that created it is beyond that personality, that sense of I that we identify with, and is actually more that greater consciousness, like reflected in the archetypal images of Jesus, Moses, Krishna, Muhammad. They're our true essence, and that's in all of us, that our experience is the reflection of our true essence. And that here, like their archetypal, their being an archetype, meaning a mental image or a symbol that derives from the collective unconscious. So they're archetypes of what it is that is creating our experience, our true self, our true essence. And so I think a lot of our dance here on earth is that relationship between the sense of I that I have as a human in the body-mind experience, emotion-thought experience, with that greater sense of I as the oneness and love that's in all things, and that relationship between the two, building that connection to expand the experience of what it is I'm creating and who it is that I am.
I like where he says, why don't you read down at the bottom of the page where he starts about midway down, where he states that I working through this body. Do you see that?
Yeah, I do. That I working through this body is the same I that is reflected in the archetypal images of Jesus, Moses, Muhammad, Krishna, all of whom reminded us and continue to remind us of our true essence. These beings are reflections or representations of our own identification with our greater, deeper I self. They are the unbroken containers of the original light, which shone from the eyes, ears, nose, and mouth of Adam Kadmon.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
I want our listeners to hear that, like I said, us discussing this is that we want you to experience this. If you took time to actually ponder and think over what she just read, just that little bit, and you just let yourself experience that, experience yourself as that being absolute and real, and knowing that the esteem and the actual credit that we give to such people as, what is that, that this is you, this is me. How much better people can we be? We can be so much greater, like to have people right now in conflict over nothing other than politics, for goodness sakes. Have we forgotten the very sacredness of each one of us individually, that we would think that separation can actually be healthy? When we're all moving to understanding that no matter how far we reach and no matter how deep the sciences go, it keeps showing us at the core of it all, we are one. We are one with the Creator itself. How much more power could we have? And that as we're learning and things happen, yeah, things will happen that are maybe something not how we would like it to happen. We'll learn from that. But right now, to actually be so closed-minded and rigid that we would practice hate of each other, that is absolutely destructive. That there is absolutely no good that can come of that. More harm and unhealthy things. But that we can put our own need to be right aside. And that's what it's saying here. How do we let this light shine through us? Well, we can't corrode our mind and our bodies with such emotional reactions. And never would we want to entertain hate. Never. To actually be so locked into something so desperately as to judge, to insult, to actually make someone else smaller than yourself over something as frivolous as politics or changes of opinions or differences of thought. This fingerprint says nobody ever was and nobody will ever be me. So we cannot expect that there will not be differences. And it shows us the beauty of the meadow and life, where we see the varieties of flowers and the textures and changes of the scenery. It's us. That's not out there. That's in us. And when we can see that and we can hold to that, then we are the Adam Cadmus. We are shedding the light. We are becoming the exactly of what our eternal selves are. It's so powerful, so very powerful. I'd like to see at this point, we have Rosemary. Rosemary, can you come over to 136 and talk to us about the light which cannot be contained?
Yes, I'd love to. And he's just going more into the difference between light and matter, and that light which cannot be contained, the light we were just talking about in the previous page. And he says that ordinary matter, as we all know, possesses inertia. It actually means that when it is stopping, it doesn't want to move. And when it moves, it doesn't want to change that movement in either direction or speed. So that is inertia. But life is not inertia. Light is actually has no rest mass, our physicists say. And I'm quoting here, light will have nothing to do with being at rest. It's always on the move. And that is us. Yes, we are not matter and inertia. We are light, but we are dealing with matter and inertia. And he goes on to explaining more deeper what matter is, that it resists and it wants to maintain the status quo. And the quantum waves are actually representing that matter, meaning the particles. And they bring that into space where or time when it can occur. So there is a background of the matter. There are waves in the background. We actually bring that into space and into time, brings matter into space and time. And this is just purely imaginal. These waves do not exist, he says. They cannot be found. And so again, we are moving into the imaginal realm. It is imaginal, and it's also part of our imaginal realm, what we are imagining. And he prefers it more to call maybe rules or guiding patterns, not waves. And these rules kind of like govern the physical, material, and realistic realities. So maybe we could also call it principles in the background, which are basically govern how matter appears in the universe. And he suggests to think of the universe as playing cards, like all the universes, the parallel universes, as playing cards. And we imagine that these cards are spread out in a certain pattern, like, for example, if you use tarot cards or solitaire, they are in a certain pattern. And so the matter in that case are the dots or the particles, you would say, on the cards. And the waves he talks about, or the rules governing it, are actually the pattern of the setup of the cards. So he say, what I understand is that there's a very subtle background of principles and rules and governing of matter. And that has to do with the light, which is actually not being able to contain it into anything. That's how I so far understood that.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. And then we go on, and I think Trina, again, would you like to pick up from there and add to that?
Oh, yes. I actually love this paragraph that about light, because he's saying that light waves, or the wave patterns that govern light, and the light waves themselves are exactly the same thing. And that we don't really see light. What we see is the effect from light, when light is pushing and pulling on matter. And we recognize that through our sensory bodies. And the image I got reading this was really, here's a light, here's spirit in us pushing and pulling our bodies around. Having movement in this, and we can see the result of the movement, but we can't define the spirit and light. And he actually says, light itself is really out of this world, and as far as I can tell, out of any parallel world we wish to think about. So science is definitely not, they don't have a definition right now, or they can't pigeonhole light and put it into a box. It's just out of this world. So after that, he moves us back into the idea that was presented in the past chapters about the leaps, leaping down the stairs, and that there were certain probabilities of certain number of leaps that could happen. And the one that actually showed up the most was three leaps could be done six different ways. So he said, from a parallel world's way of thinking, though, the six different three-leap scenarios overlap and constitute a memory in which the differences in the leaps, the details of each step that were actually taken, are fuzzy or simply not recorded in memory. So when we have these different imaginary, maybe stories, imaginal, happening, and it can happen in so many different ways, if we're not really paying attention, if we're not aware of all these things going on, we don't necessarily create the memory. The memory can be fuzzy or not recorded at all. And so going back to what Rosemary had brought forward about the fact that he says these waves of matter are purely imaginal ordering rules, and that they're waves of imagination. Our imagination jumps into this. And what we remember is based upon how aware we are. It's about our memories, about what we take in via the senses. So sometimes we just don't even record what's going on around us.
Okay. Can we move ahead? Ladies, please pay attention that we're running out of time, and the ending here is very much needed to sum this up. So Geraldine, can you pick it up from there? And then let's move right on through here, okay? Geraldine?
The key point here is, again, that the light is us. It says that. It's not anywhere else. The light is us. He says if you're going through a flip book or you're jumping downstairs, that is us. That's light. And then a key word, the most likely distribution, because he says the same light in any parallel, the most likely distribution is what is remembered. So again, it's showing us that what's possible, anything, what's probable is up to our thoughts and emotions that will make what's most likely. That's what's key here. It's all possible. Us determine what's most likely and what eventuates.
Thank you. Okay, Marianne?
Yeah, just to move on from that, the bottom line in the next bit is that all the other possible events that occur can also exist in our memory. So we're able to go into memory through meditation and recall all the other possible sequences of events. Like if you recall how we spoke about jumping down the steps in all the different sequences. And so we might have just jumped down from 1 to 3, but we can actually recall all the other combinations through meditation is the bottom line of the next part of this.
Okay. Joyce?
Yeah, the most important points in this section was around inertia. And that looking back on chapter 4, one can see that inertia is required for existence and creativity. So the most important statement he makes here is that beauty arises as a difference from ordinariness, and that we need both beauty and inertia together, as spoken in the first little paragraph at the beginning of this chapter, that is necessary for life.
I love that. It says beauty arises as the difference from ordinariness. Did you hear that? Beauty arises as the difference from ordinariness. And we have that constantly in our life. What I'd like to do is have Rosemary actually read the last couple of paragraphs of this chapter, which is called The Awakening the New Vision.
Yes. Awakening the New Vision. New alchemy takes place at the frontier of the imaginal realm. Our personal experiments in new alchemy produce new information and new transformational possibilities, entering our dreams and, possibly more importantly, our waking thoughts. We awaken to a new vision of life and time. New meaning alters and changes what we believe, and hence what we experience physically in the world, both personally and globally. The new alchemy gives us a new and ancient vision of mind, body, spirit, and soul, and a new understanding of how the forces of purpose, creation, and transformation within each of us, when used consciously, can enhance the meaningfulness of everyday life. And the possibilities are unlimited. As I ponder my own existence, I see that as species, we often resist change and certainly transformational possibilities presented to us. Perhaps we seek to simply exist on automatic pilot, not having to deal with anything new. Passing through my 60s, I see that I have often resisted transformational possibilities when they have presented themselves to me. I can't tell you that every opportunity passed over necessarily led to some personal disaster in my life, but I can tell you that when I took advantage of a possibility and turned it into a reality, it always opened a new vision of myself, my relationship with the world, and the people closest to me. Becoming something, turning a vision into an actuality, is not always easy. I hope that you have found in the pages of this book a little guidance in turning your dreams into realities.
Very, very good. Very, very good. So is there any commentary that you'd like to express and what you've read and sum up some of what we've discussed here? And we do have some guests. If Michael, I see a list here that I have Michael Callahu, Mary Smith, and Mary Ann, also Steve Jones. Any of you want to give some commentary on what we've just discussed? None of you are on? Okay, co-host.
I can see Mike wants to share there, Grandmother.
Mike wants to share? Okay, Mike, can you come on?
Sure. Can you hear me?
There you are. We can see you, too. It's great.
Cool. A couple of things. I had read this book many years ago, and even highlighted some areas of it the first time I went through. And reading back through it again, it astounds me. And I look back purposely to see when it was first published, and it was like around the year 2000, which is, you know, I think it was, 2001. So it's over 20 years ago, and he's saying things in this book that are like so apropos with what's going on right now and the discoveries in quantum physics and things that are going on, that it just kind of blows me away that this guy was so tuned in way back when. And you and I met him, and he's a bit of a quirky guy, like you said.
Yes, yeah, he surely is.
but he's kind of comical, but he was really right on. I've been listening to Nassim Harriman's videos, and he is like on the cutting edge of stuff. And I see the parallels between this book and Nassim's videos that so many times I've wanted to jump into the discussion and say, yep, and Nassim describes it this way, but it's exactly the same thing. So if people have not watched those videos, they are awesome, and it's a whole series, and it's good, and it just backs up everything that's right here. It just blows me away that he comes at it the same thing from a different angle, but it's so well explained. So I appreciate going through it a second time.
I agree. Well, I think most of us have gone through it at least twice, if not more. I use it as a teaching base. So I go through them. I think I've already gone through three books because they get pretty tattered. But nothing is old. And the reason I actually recommend this is what you just said. Everything he's saying, though it's 20 years old, he's right in the now and he's right on the points. And other scientists like Nassim are actually proving at a greater extent exactly what he said. So it is, it's absolutely rewarding. And the thing of it is the more we learn, even if we're not applying all of what we understand, the more we apply and the more we can contemplate and think about this. It's like right now in our world, there are so many conflicts and things that if we just look at what we're creating and have responsibility for our own role in what's happening, how well we could change it. And however we have any emotion that actually tries to be harmful toward another or any part of creation, there is things that happen in us that are not healthy because we actually are going against our own nature. And that's the beautiful part of us. We're every bit and then some of what he describes here. So like I said, I would hope our listeners please buy this book and take it paragraph by paragraph, and don't just rush through it. It's not something you sit down and just hurry and rush through. You want to stop after you read a little bit of it and ask yourself, what is that? How, you know, what do I see in that? How does that work in everyday life? And the point that he makes here, we return to where we begin. So that just puts so much more meaning through life every day. Every day for us to sit and contemplate the fact that if we do something today, just even if it's one thing that we could say was actually an unselfish and a wholeness toward all life, and realize that that split second or that little bit of time is so enormous in the effects as it moves out through and across the world. So taking time to meditate, taking time to appreciate and be grateful for something is an antidote to the hate and the separation and the destruction. So you want to take those moments and create that very, very often. And we thank Dr. Wolf for actually bringing a lot of that to our attention. Now, next week, we will be talking about, we're going into the end of the book, which is the, somebody say that word for me. The appendix, okay.
Appendix.
Yeah, and so we're actually going to be able to read that. He sums up a lot in that. And when I look at mine, almost every line is highlighted. So again, this is something that you'll want to definitely pay attention to. And I want to end tonight's show with actually quoting Albert Einstein, which he has as the quote for the appendix. I want to know God's thoughts. The rest are details. Isn't that powerful? All right. So thank you very much, and we'll catch you next week. And this is Quantum Leap Book Club. Thank you for joining us. OCO.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.